reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man still driving and striving.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the special 25th edition of the In the Gravel Trap podcast. I'm your host, Adam Tate of Tribute Racing. I am joined this evening, as always, by Joey Barnes of Tribute Racing and Mr. Josh Farmer. We'll have Frank Santoroski of Draft in the Circuit and Christopher Hardy of Motorsport.com coming in a bit later. But we'll intro now. Had a very eventful weekend here in the United States side of racing. Lots going on in the world of NASCAR and IndyCar. IndyCar was down at Barber Motorsports Park in beautiful and scenic Birmingham, Alabama. And that is where we are going to start off, is talking about IndyCar. Josh, Joey, what are your thoughts on how the racing took place this weekend?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and go first. I mean, I thought the race was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, Barber, you know, in the pre-DW12 era, the race at Barber had tended to not to be Snoresville. But, I mean, but this year, I mean, they're passing throughout, and the Henderson, Tennessee zone, Joseph Newgarden broke through and finally got his first win after coming so close yet so far. And honestly, that kid, he, you know, he outmuscled two Penske guys on the first lap and then made the most of it when Elio had a problem on pit road. And then he had some pit road problems himself, but then he went ahead but then he managed to get by Elio again on under green, and then he held off a hard charging Graham Rahal for second for the win, and I got to give a shout out to Graham Rahal too. I mean, I know we've been very very hard on the guy for a number of years of saying, you know, when's this kid going to finally get it together, but yesterday, he had four fresh red tires at the end, but you know, I mean, he didn't put a wheel wrong the entire race, and he pretty much carried the flag for Honda. So, all in all, a very good race, and you know, Joseph Newgarden winning, you know, I mean, I think Newgarden is something that IndyCar needs to capitalize on, because I mean, he's young, he's American, he's talented, he's personable as hell in front of the camera, and I think all it takes is a win, and you know, I wouldn't bet against Newgarden winning the GP of Indy or the Indy 500, to be honest with you.
Yeah, the race was absolutely phenomenal. I know I ended up catching it a little bit late, and Frank started giving me little messages about what was going on, and I was like, shut up, Frank, I'm not home yet to watch it. And I finally got a chance. I ended up getting caught up, got in real time, and I saw Joseph's first moves at the start of the race, and that was absolutely phenomenal driving on his part. But, you know, Josh, I'm going to counter your we're waiting on this Graham Rahal kid to get together, and it looks like he finally did. Graham Rahal is good for one or two second-place runs a year, and that's just the God's honest truth. And I think at the end of the day, this is one of his two uses for the year. He's got one more left in him for maybe at Belle Isle in one of the races. But I think, you know, I'm looking down the running order here, and I'm more shocked about, obviously, there's pit strategy and fuel that came into play, and Elio really got snubbed at the very last lap, had to come in and hit her two, with two to go, had to pit. And is everything okay over there?
Yeah.
And then you had Carlos Munoz, who actually really surprised me. I didn't realize he finished well. He did once everything was said and done. Green home a six. I was really surprised by that. So all in all, I was really pleasantly surprised that Graham was as fast as he was, passing the outside of turn five three times on three different drivers and almost doing it to Dixon in the same corner. I think he may have – done it on the last lap. I'm not too familiar with what passed Dixon on the last lap, but you know, outside of that, Sage Karam ran a little too aggressively. I've been saying it for a while that this kid is a lot of people are hyped him up to be more than what he is, in my opinion, and he continues to show that he isn't very much, except for maybe an oval racer. And shout out to Francesco Dracone. Good job on finishing last for like fourth or fifth or fifth time in your career. And God, I hope he's done. I mean, he was running 3 or 4 seconds off the pace per lap. People were catching him in places, and he was holding up trains of cars. Absolutely horrible. And I think at the end of the day, that guy just needs to be done. So, Frank, what are your thoughts on this?
I thoroughly enjoyed the Barber Motorsports race. I think I have to disagree with you that this is one of Graham Rahal's, one-and-done performances. I think this guy is going to be tough to deal with all year long. He's waved the Honda flag as long as he can, and he's been consistently up there. And he was absolutely spectacular in the closing stages of the race. At the same time, Joseph Newgarden, great job to them. And when they get to Indy, you've got Ed Carpenter with the experience at Indy, experience in the ovals. I cannot imagine how strong this team is going to be. You got J.R. Hildebrand, who nearly won there back in 2011. And I just think this team is going to be tough to beat, Penske aside.
Frank, I just got to say one thing. We had the nice little show that we talked about our predictions and whatnot, and I just got to say, how about that vibe that I got, huh?
Yeah, you did good, man.
Do what I can. Adam, what's up?
The main thing that strikes me about this race as a positive, other than Newgarden winning his first race, which is excellent for him, great for the newly combined team, great to see a young American winning an Indy car that seems to be what the fans are always pushing for. But if you look, you had a Honda in second place. You had a Honda in fifth place. If you look, you had a Honda in last, but you had some Chevrolets at the back of the field. And even the hopeless Dracone was only one lap down on the field. There's been a lot of talk about the aero kits killing the close competition that we've been seeing each year with the DW12 chassis. It's not like they're going to open up a big gap and everything, but if you look, it was really close throughout the entire race. The margin of victory was just over 2 seconds. Everybody, minus Jakes and Dracone, who had issues of their own during the race, other than being slow, was on the lead lap. That tells me IndyCar is still as competitive as ever. Barber is a great facility. I think one of the reasons this race was so good is the fact that they're finally on a natural terrain road course again. And that's no disrespect to NOLA. They could not help the rain. It's no disrespect to the street circuits in St. Pete or Long Beach, which are good for street circuits. But these big, fast cars with all this downforce, they are made for a natural terrain road course. And Barber's one of the best in the U.S. So I'm glad to see that they finally got out there and that IndyCar put on a great show for the fans.
You touched on it a little bit, and maybe with this elevation changes and whatnot, we saw an equalizer between Honda and Chevrolet aero kits, because even though in qualifying Chevy was still ridiculously fast, I mean, if you look at this running order, it literally is Chevy, Honda, Chevy, Chevy, Honda, 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 Chevy. I mean, essentially, I think you're looking at 5 and 5 on the Honda-Chevy scale. I think it's even 5 and 5 for the top 10. And we'll see what happens on the ovals, but ultimately I'm really interested to see how they handle the Grand Prix of Indy. I think that that's really going to be the telltale. I don't know. When do they get their first updates on the road courses? Does anybody know?
I'm not sure on that one.
But
technically, it's up to the Honda or Chevy camps when they want to do that. there, it's all about ticking those legality boxes for development. So I would not be surprised to see the first ones come out either for the GP of Indy or maybe hold off until right after Indianapolis. They come in for Belle Isle.
Yeah, that makes sense. How about Will Power getting penalized but still coming back to finish fourth? I mean, he got penalized a slew last year, just ran his ass off, and obviously there's still no care, no dams given for him. I mean, that guy's still full throttle all the way, and he was really trying hard this weekend after what happened last weekend at Long Beach with the 20th place finish. That, I mean, you know, sometimes he has – you look at Houston last year, you know, sometimes he just has those blur standing still moments where you just don't know what happened to him. And he came out saying that this was an important race. And, you know, if anybody watched qualifying, he was going for it in the rain on reds – not rain, but, you know, like drizzle. And he had that thing sideways almost in every corner, a handful of steering – I mean, he was going for it, and he ended up ultimately getting outside pole. But, I mean, to say he doesn't want it every single time he gets out on the track, he's still going 90-0 as a champion.
Yeah, but, you know, in my mind, the bigger issue is what is going on with Penske Racing. You know, we've got these guys who have been so lovey-dovey and you know, kiss one another and cheek, but suddenly we have, you're talking Penske, you know, four races, four poles, one win. I think there's some chinks in the armor right there that we need to look at. Maybe that's just me, but I don't. It you know, blows my mind that Penske cars finished fourth, ninth, 14th, and 15th at the Barber. So,
you know, that's a good point you bring up, Frank, with that. But really, I'm looking at Power and how strong he was all weekend, as Joey was saying, going for the pole and the reds and the drizzle and everything. If it weren't for that penalty, if it weren't for the collision in the first place and then the subsequent penalty he earned, I'd wager that Power would have been right there on Newgarden, possibly even more than Rahal was, and maybe even winning, and it would have been another Will Power lights the flag kind of victory.
And perhaps, yeah, but, you know, we'll never know, because that's why they won the race, why they run the race.
Exactly.
So, side
note. Did you bring up a good point, Joey?
I was just going to say, side note here, something that I would be hard-pressed to mention since we do a little bit on the Mazda Road to Indy side is Rising Star Racing, their trio of Neil Albarico, Spencer Pigot, and now Joseph Newgarden. They all swept and cleaned up in their respective races. I say swept. I don't think Albarico swept, but he won one out of two. And they all won in their respective classes over the course of the weekend at Barber. I mean, for a small group like that, that is phenomenal. Silence. Nobody has anything to add on that one. Nobody knows about Rising Star Racing.
Oh, Rising Star is great. I mean, you bring up a great point. So it is quite phenomenal to see a small group punching above their weight the way they are.
What do you guys make of Sage Karam and his – I mean, everybody knows what we think of Dracone by now after what we did the other day, bashing, ha-ha, pilot. You know, but what do we think of Sage Karam at this point? I mean, when you look at some of the moves that he did during the course of the race were very questionable, especially given his pace. And given where he was, he qualified respectively well. I think he qualified 10th, if memory serves me right. But when it was time to get the hell out of the way, that's the last thing he did. And he made things really difficult for the senior members, if you want to say, the champions of the sport. Are we done with Sage Karam? Is he already listed as a bust, or is he listed as kind of a very raw version of I don't know, a Marco Andretti, maybe somebody that can run the ovals extremely fast? But, you know, Marco eventually got better at road courses, but it took him some time.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that, in addition, that Sage told me after the race at St. Petersburg, the one thing that he doesn't have the experience in is fuel conservation, because I mean in Indy Lights, excuse me, they're, you know, they usually, you know, there's no pit stop,
and what have you. So, I mean, that's one thing. But, you know, but still, I mean, going from driving an Indy Lights car that has a top speed of 180 miles an hour and doesn't have nearly as much downforce as an Indy car, you know, it probably has, you know, I don't have the exact numbers, but it has a lot more downforce than there's, you know. You know, he's still learning the limits. I mean, I think it's too early to tell if he's going to be a bust. But, you know, I mean, I expect him to run better at the Indy 500 and then given some time. And, you know, he's got Dario Franchitti mentoring him. So, you know, I would say it's too early to tell to make it a Reader's Digest version.
You know, Josh.
Yes, Joey.
Go ahead, Joey. Joey, are you there?
Okay, well, it's not like Joey's there, but I won't say Sage is the bust just yet. But at the same time, you know, he had a brilliant showing at his inaugural Indy 500 last year. But I think this guy just needs some more time in the car. You know, he's thrown in the car here and there, but he's not there when they're testing. So I think. Yeah, I was telling that they put Savager in the car, and he was pretty stout there. But at the same time, Savager's got how many, you know, IndyCar starts in his career? 24, 25. Sage has, what, two? So, yeah, don't write Sage off yet. I think this kid's got a brilliant career ahead of him. He just needs to figure it out.
I'm here, Adam.
What?
I'm here, Adam.
Oh, it says you're not connected. Please call in. So Joey got disconnected. I'll call in as a host again. Hold on.
Having technical difficulties here, folks? Just hang on.
Hey, everybody. You guys there?
I'm here, Adam.
Okay. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. We had some technical difficulties jump in there and knock us off the air for a minute. We were talking about IndyCar racing. So we were all talking about Sage Karam. I'll give my thoughts on Karam. I think he is a very talented young driver. I also think he's kind of a douche. He's very cocky, very brash. He kind of bullies some people off the track. So I think he has a lot of raw talent. It's just a matter of Ganassi harnessing that. And as Frank was pointing out, he only has a handful of IndyCar starts. I think he'll calm down and mature, but he needs that seat time, and he needs that to continue on. Would you agree with that, Josh?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Okay, awesome. Chris, are you there?
I am here, guys.
Awesome. Well, you were there at Barber for the IndyCar weekend. Why don't you give us your take on how the race went, some of your observations, you know, what was the feel like within the paddock there?
Well, let's go from bottom ladder to top, really. I want to talk about real quick about Mazda Road Indy, USF 2000. Aaron Tielitz won the first race there, made a fantastic outside pass on Joey's guy, Franzoni, I think it was. The pro mods, the races that they had there, Ware and Tan won the first race. The second race, he was sent to the back for a really bad, so he didn't really have that good of a weekend. Spencer Pigot swept the weekend for Indy Lights, did a fantastic job, led both races green to checkered. Now, for the big stars, IndyCar, tell you what, Newgarden made some fantastic moves heading to the first turn. He drove that race like he wanted to win. So bad. I loved seeing his first lap, especially him getting around power there for second place on the first lap. Then again, looking at strategy and all, Newgarden's team honestly called the perfect race. They saw that Dixon was gaining on him at a rate of about a half a second to a second per lap. They called him in when Newgarden had about a 5-second lead. Dixon had to come in the very next lap. Boom. Newgarden was able to stay in front and couldn't be challenged. Unless, of course, the race would have gone 95 laps, and otherwise Graham Rahal would have caught him. Rahal's team played it perfect for strategy. They put in sticker red tires with 20 laps to go, and he did a great job getting to the finish there, passing Scott Dixon on the last lap. It was a fantastic race, in my opinion.
A very fantastic race. And, hey, look, we have Joey Barnes back on the line. Joey, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, there's technical difficulties.
Well, we're glad you're back. Chris is here now. He gave us kind of a rundown of his views on the race. What was the feel like within the garage there, Chris? What kind of vibes are you getting from the teams? How are the fans enjoying it? What was the overall impression of the weekend?
Well, Newgarden was just so ecstatic. And, I mean, the main drivers that weren't too happy with the whole situation was Charlie Kimball and Montoya. Kimball, because Hawksworth, he says, overtook him before the green flag came out for a restart. sorry about that, y'all. Meanwhile, for Montoya, he had two front wings I think they had to get replaced, and he and Kimball had a little incident there in turns 8-9 that he wasn't too thrilled about taking place. It wasn't necessarily a good thing for Montoya, considering how many times he had to pit. I think he finished like 14th or 15th. It wasn't really too good of a race for either one of them, and some drivers really ticked off at race control. One more thing I do want to mention is that apparently Joseph Newgarden does not drink. Scott Dixon and Graham Rahal kind of forced him to drink some champagne, but Newgarden said he really just wanted to taste the victory. So ultimately, it was really funny for him and the good press conference for both, all three of them.
That's good. Did you get a chance to? I was going to ask more about the Kimball and Montoya thing. Did you get a chance to talk to either one of those guys after that incident?
Yes, I did. In fact, I actually have a story up on motorsport.com where I spoke with both of them. Kimball and Montoya weren't too pleased with each other. I spoke to them separately. Though Kimball wasn't too pleased with race control because, you know, they had some debris at St. Pete and at Long Beach, and they didn't throw yellows too quickly. But at Barber, they threw the yellow instantly, so they said they weren't being consistent, and that Hawksworth only got a warning for passing before the green flag came out. And Montoya only got a warning for his issue with Kimball. So Kimball really wasn't too pleased with race control after the race was over.
Yeah, well,
would you view it as a racing incident?
Yeah, it was just two guys that are going for a position, and neither one of them were willing to give an inch, really. That's the way I look at it.
Okay, sorry about that, Josh. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'll go ahead and kind of chime in on that if it's just, you know, I mean, obviously, you know the Brian Barnhart bashing is, but it's just the inconsistency of race control. I'm not sure who. I mean, like you said, Kimball wasn't too happy, but it's like, you know, they called a penalty on Will Power, which I would say that was warranted. I mean, Will obviously didn't, you know, it looked like to me he didn't even think to look to see if Sato was there, you know. Then again, the blend at Barber's a little funky, but you know, they didn't call a penalty, but yet they didn't call a penalty on Montoya when it looked pretty deliberately that Montoya was pissed and didn't seem to care to move Charlie out of the way. And it's just, you know, and then of course, you know, going back to the issues in NOLA during qualifying, you know, it's just. You know, it's just I hope we're not returning back to the 2011 state of affairs on how crazy race control was. I hope that, you know, I hope either things get better or things don't get better. Someone inside the paddock starts raising hell because it's just the inconsistency in race control, and then the climate is always going to be questioned. It's not like, I mean, in Formula One, you know, Charlie Lane makes the call, and that's it. I mean, but then again, Charlie usually always makes good calls.
Very true. Very true. Well, moving on, Josh, we've got the Tudor United Sports Car Championship heading to Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca this upcoming weekend. It's one of their first real visits to a natural terrain road course as well. What are you looking for there this weekend?
Well, I'm looking to see the Wayne Taylor boys putting on another dominating performance. I mean, it's like the start of the year, you know, they screwed up their drive time at Daytona, which ultimately cost them a win and the podium. And then Sebring, you know, had they have not had the problem early in the race, you know, they would have won. And then Long Beach, you know, they dominated that entire day. So I mean, I think Wayne Taylor Racing found something. So I'm looking for Jordan and Ricky to go out and flat out dominate. And in the prototype challenge, I would say, I mean, Core Autosports is the team to beat most of the years, but PR1 Mathiasen is on the hottest streak of their career with back-to-back wins at St. Pete and or not St. Pete. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. But at Daytona and Sebring. And you know, with Mike Gwosh and I believe Tom Kibbersmith driving with them. I mean,
yes.
they've been on a tear. And you know, but in the two GT classes, I couldn't even begin to tell you. I mean, it's wide open as a NASCAR plate race. Last week we saw the Ricci Ferrari, you know, lead most of the race and its brakes went out, but Dirk Werner put on a hell of a performance. I mean, I was at that race and he was. You know, he was the star, and you know the car got really fast once they changed the tires, and he was, and so I mean in GTLM I honestly shouldn't put down a winner, and then in GTD it's like the Vipers are quick, both Alex Shove cars are quick, and you know I couldn't even begin to tell you who I think could win there.
Oh, I couldn't really either. Looking at it, I didn't quite realize this close to it, a bit of reading earlier. But the last 14 races, there have been 14 different pole sitters in GTLM. And that stretches all the way back to last year's 24 Hours of Daytona. So you want to talk about a competitive class. That's really quite possibly the most competitive class of racing in the world right now. 14 different teams, same pole. It's quite awesome, actually. So, you know, last time it was Bill Auberlin. Bill Auberlin is a consummate professional. He is the kind of guy that can take that BMW and really take Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan to the front again. I'm thinking Ricci is going to get there in just desserts, though. They ran so strongly, and to not get the victory at Long Beach was really hard on them. So I think they'll bounce back. As far as prototypes, I think you hit the nail on the head. The Taylor brothers seem to be rejuvenated. They seem to have the best chemistry of all the teams. I mean, Action Express is a really strong lineup. But there's something about the fact that it's two brothers, they're racing for their father. It's a really good, compelling story, even if they don't succeed. And here they are really succeeding and enjoying themselves. You know, if you've never gotten a chance to look, they put up a bunch of hilarious YouTube videos. The guys just goofing off and having a really great time. But at the same time, they know when to buckle down and be serious and charge ahead. I still think one of the Ligier cars has a shot. You know, Mike Shank has got that thing. It's easily the quickest P2-based car around, either in Tudor, in European Le Mans, in WEC, anywhere you want to go. So I really think they still have a shot. But they got to strike now before I think the Taylor brothers run away with this. Josh?
Yeah, I mean the Ligier was not competitive at all at Long Beach, but then again, that's the first time that kind of car has ever raced on the street circuit. You know, I mean AJ Allmendinger took the fastest lap in the Shank car at Daytona, and at Sebring, Olivier Plaut was walking away with it at the beginning, and then until Tracy Krohn made an error. You know, I mean, I'm glad to see so far the balance of performance on the prototype class. There hasn't been too many changes. It's been mostly limited to the two GT classes. So, but yeah, given the nature of Laguna Seca, I think, you know, a P2 car won last year with Extreme Speed Motorsports, Johannes van Overbeck and Ed Brown, but I could easily see the MSR car winning without a doubt. But what's also kind of concerning is is, you know, even though I would say it's kind of an engineering exercise, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but the Delta Wing Racing, they have failed to finish a single race so far in the Tudor Championship. You know, I mean, the thing was fast at Daytona, then the gearbox broke, and then Sebring, the same story, and then Long Beach, it's just the car is not really suited for a street circuit, but you know, then they still yet to finish a race. I mean, so I've kind of got some concerns there that it's like, you know, there seemed to be a little bit of hype about it, and you know it seems like their fifth place finish at the first time they ran the Petit Le Mans seems like a very distant memory at this point.
It sadly does, and they're a strong outfit. I mean, you've got Mimo Rojas in there, you've got Catherine Legg, you've got Tim Keane. It's a good group. It is worth noting, however, like the Ligiers, that was their street circuit debut at Long Beach last go-around. It was also the street circuit debut for the Delta Wing. I think Laguna Seca will suit it a little better. If you want to compare, Laguna Seca is a very undulating, traditional road course, much in the way Road Atlanta is, where they scored their superb fifth place with that Petit Le Mans a while back. So I think they've got a good shot. I'm curious to watch the Delta Wing go through the corkscrew, though. I feel like that's going to be a very, very interesting thing. So I just hope they can finish, rather than even finish well, but just put a good result together, keep their head down. It's kind of like McLaren Honda over in Formula One. Their goal was just to finish. Armaner and Marussia, just to finish. Delta Wing needs to get some good laps in. Hopefully their gearbox doesn't break. Hopefully no one, you know, knocks them off course, because it can be kind of hard to see when they're in your blind spot. So it'll be really curious. Joe, you got any thoughts going into this for Laguna Seca? I know it's your favorite track in all of the land.
I just think the Delta Wing is slowly but surely a failed project. I just, you look at it and it's just, the car, the body style, it's very fragile. I don't really see how you can have close-to-close wheel-to-wheel racing. I mean, you look at the blind spot aspect that you just mentioned, but you also look at the different design that it has, and honestly, it's unlike anything else. I mean, you can't go wheel-to-wheel with it like you could a Ligier versus, you know, one of the Fords. It's just, It can't happen. It's not a prototypical car, and I think, you know, that's why it's easy to knock off course. It's why it's easy to wreck. And ultimately, unless it can steer clear and go way out to the front, which they'll never get to that point because they never run enough laps to get enough technology built up, because they keep getting knocked out. I think it's a project that right now is in damage control, and slowly but surely we're going to see it fade. As far as the track, love the track, love what's there. I'm just ready to see IndyCar there, and I'm ready to see a lot of other things there. It's my favorite facility, brings back a lot of memories, and you know, it everything that's touched that track has been good racing. So I don't, for the life of me, you know, if you can put on a good show, you can fill the stands, and if you can fill the stands, why not? You know, because obviously, if you can put asses in the seats, you can slowly but surely fix the facilities that need to be fixed. That's just my take. I know that's why some series don't go there at the moment. But outside of that, I'd love to see bikes there. I don't really have a whole lot of interest in seeing a Delta Wing try to run around.
Yeah, I could not agree more about other series needing to go there. It's a great facility. It's a classic track with so many memories for people. It is worth noting that the Tudor Championship is going to be the most prestigious and the fastest series to visit Monza Raceway Laguna Seca this year. Opposite of the Delta Wing, you do have the SkyActiv Speed Source Mazda still plugging along, still using that stock block diesel. Slowly but surely, they've made up ground. They will want to have a good showing at their quote-unquote home track. But, you know, they're not in as dire straits as Delta Wing, but they still have a long way to go. So I'm really looking forward to it. Frank, did you have any thoughts on that?
You know what? I would love to see Laguna Seca back on the IndyCar calendar. I disagree that the Sports Car Series is the most prestigious series to ever hit Laguna Seca, but yeah, I love that track. I love the venue. I remember years and years ago watching a IMSA race there with you know, Peter Gregg and David Hobbs. Back when those guys drove, that track is so wonderful, so prestigious. I'd love to see it back on the IndyCar calendar, but you know, keep it in sports cars. You know, just keep it relevant. Keep that track around. It's awesome.
Could not agree more. We also have coming up this weekend the World Endurance Championship, going to one of everyone's favorite circuits, Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium. Guys, what are we looking to see there, Joey?
Probably nothing more than typical Toyota Denso domination, but hopefully, you know, as far as I, you guys pay attention to the GT classes and whatnot, and to be honest with you, I mean, if you don't win overall, in my opinion, you just don't win. So I look at the top of the sheets, and I look at the prototypes, and I, you know, obviously all of us have talked about Rebellion, and it'd be nice to see them up their game, and I'm definitely an avid fan of Rebellion, but at the end of the day, I'm going to slowly but surely have hope that Porsche and Audi have something for them to really make this a very interesting race. And we had a chance to see a little bit of a sample at Silverstone. I personally don't like the track too much, but I love Spa, and I think that that track with these cars, that's the kind of track you want to run these cars on. And it's big, wide, fast. You know, it's a little tighter at Silverstone, so this could really play to the strengths of Porsche. So we'll see. You know, it's all about being able to close the deal and showing that they're for real. So we'll just see what happens on that end.
Well, you know, you talked about the Denso domination, which is a perfect headline for last season for Toyota that I wish one of us would use now. But if you go back to Silverstone, Porsche was the quickest in qualifying. They were also the quickest in preseason testing that Paul Ricard had done in France. And it was a pretty epic battle between them and Audi. You might say experience on Audi side helped them pull out the victory there, double stinting the tires. So really, it looks like Toyota's kind of on the back foot. But granted, they do have the most powerful car, at least until Nissan comes online. I do think they can have kind of a striking back, as it were. But the Porsche, very, very nimble. So I think you may be within luck, and I think they may have a good shot here at Spa. You had some news, Josh?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't really say it's breaking news, but Extreme Speed Motorsports, they completed a shakedown test of their new Ligier JSP2 chassis. I mean, Extreme Speed has been very competitive in the WEC. I mean, ever since their debut at COTA, they were very quick, and you know, they finished on the podium, and then they got another podium at China, and then they ended up getting a podium at Silverstone, but they were excluded for the front and rear plank, did not meet the minimum thickness, but ESM completed a shakedown of their Ligier JSP2 chassis, which should be a good holdover. I mean, I know HPD is still trying to bring up their new ARX chassis from what I understand after talking to a team representative at St. Petersburg, that they were really not pleased with the way that car ran in Daytona. So with Ligier under their belt, I mean, I think, you know, it's the playing field's going to be leveled a little bit more, and looking for a good result from our home guys here in the States to run.
The interesting thing about that to me is HPD is putting all these resources, ESM is putting all these resources in its new HPD car. And it shows a severe lack of faith and a severe lack of development. And they have to back out of it and go to this Ligier, which is considered the state-of-the-art P2 car around. Everyone else is using them. They're loving them. They're having lots of success over in Europe.
not as much here in the States, but the potential is clearly there. My question is this. If they just nail the setup with that Ligier, you know, how invested are they in still bringing that HPD car back? It'd be a huge financial loss. But either way, they're burning that money right now by racing a car that they're not going to end the season with, they're not going to start next season with.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting, too, with the current LMP2 situation. I mean, everything's still up in the air. I mean, well, I wouldn't say it's really up in the air. I think things are just in the crossing teeth and dying eye phase with the FIA, the WEC, the ACO, and IMSA of you know, in 2017 we're going to have a new LMP2 car, and there's probably only going to be a few constructors, and it's going to be a spec engine. So I wonder if Honda, you know, if Honda just realized, you know, hey, we've got this car. It's not that good, but the car is going to be irrelevant come 2016. So I wonder if that had to play into factor in it at all.
You know, I think it would, and this is a question I want to ask all of you guys. You know, it's great that IMSA and ACO and FIA and everybody are working together for this P2 change in 2017. I'm not sure how I feel about having a stock engine. Or not rather a stock engine, but a single engine among all of them, turning into more of a spec class. But, you know, P2 has gotten fascinating. The past several years has grown and grown. Nissan jumped on board, Ligier, HPD, all these guys are putting a lot of resources into it and making it a really exciting level of racing to watch. Do you think it's a good move to go to this standard chassis in 2017?
Well, I'm not a fan of spec car racing by any means. I mean, but then again, as you have mentioned before, the number one issue in racing is cost. So I wonder, you know, if limiting the cost would get more guys involved. Because would you happen to know? How much has the LMP2 grid fluctuated in the ELMS and WEC and even the ALMS before the merger? I don't think the grid counts have been that extremely high. And then obviously in the WEC, the LMP1 class has taken off with for so many years it was Audi, Audi, Audi. And now, you know, we've got Porsche, Toyota, and then eventually Nissan at Le Mans. That you know LMP1 has taken off, and yet LMP2 is kind of really hasn't changed much. So I don't know. I mean, then again, regulation changes have they make proposals and then they make changes. So I don't know. I'll probably have a better opinion once they fully announce the 2017 specs at the 24 Hours of Le Mans this year.
That's a good point. Joey, Frank, you got anything to add to that?
You know, I would just love to see sports car racing succeed in the United States. We've seen uptimes, downtimes, whatnot. You know, as a kid, I loved the IMSA series, but WEC is great. The Tudor series is fantastic, particularly in the early part of the season when they put on the 24 Hours of Daytona. But then it's so far under the radar that engine changes, chassis changes, this and that. I don't know if anything's going to matter until they get anything else better going on to really get this in front of the fans a little more.
Yeah, well, another thing that I kind of want to mention is that, like what you talked about, sports car racing. You know, fan base. It really is a really niche market series. I mean, obviously the American sports car series. Before it had its own split, like kind of like the CART IRL split. You know, the split between professional sports car and Grand Am, but then professional sports car ended up becoming ALMS. From that point on, because the sports car crowds have never been good, except Sebring has always been shoulder to shoulder in the 24 hours of Le Mans. But like, I mean, if you look at the crowds at Silverstone, there was only 55,000 people. I don't know if that was the weekend attendance or not, but it's like essentially, I mean, sports car racing. I mean, I think the racing, you know, is great, and the manufacturer relevancy, you know, I think at WEC can really rival Formula One in terms of international popularity. You know, I think extending the calendar, but really, you know, it's just it doesn't seem to really have a spectator following, but you know, I mean, except for Le Mans and Sebring, so. So, but yeah, I mean, then again, it kind of brings up a point that we talked on the show that it's like American sports car racing, you know, it lives and dies and lives and dies, but then the Pirelli World Challenge has been constant for the last 25 years because they've largely stayed within their boundaries.
Well, I think, that's a good point. You know, when you look at everything, y'all are asking me about what I think about this and that and the other. At the end of the day, what WEC has done so far, I've been 100% on board with up to this point, and I wish that Tudor would do more of it. I wish that we had an authentic P2. I wish we had more separation, you know, instead of what eventually happened with ALMS and Grandam with the merger and combining cars that honestly were completely different. I mean, cars that had no chance at scoring an overall victory were put in the same class as cars that could. And it just, to me, that was absolute junk. And I thought it was a crappy way to run it because money is tight. This is racing. They built themselves up. I mean, Muscle Milk is the perfect example. Muscle Milk Picket Racing isn't even consistently racing anymore at the sports car level. And they were completely dominant in ALMS. And it was strictly for the fact that they, if there was a P2 class there, boy, they would have kicked everybody's ass. But, you know, whether it was NASCAR saying, we're not going to implement this, we're going to do things closer to the Grand Am way, or whatever power trip happened to take place to make the rules the way they were, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like part of it was a really steep learning curve and they didn't adjust. And I think that's where WEC is doing it right. And that's why I've got no rebuttal to what WEC does at this point, because they know how to look after themselves. The only thing that I can say is I wish there was more tracks on the calendar. But outside of that, they're growing at a rate that's comfortable for them. And I'm pretty sure in due time we'll see them put more tracks on the calendar. But ultimately, I mean, they're doing everything the way that they feel they need to do. They consult with their teams probably better than we do over here. And when you've got teams over here leaving to go over there, and that's an international series versus just a continental series over here, something needs to be said for that. You know, the cost seems to be the same or cheaper to race internationally with that series. And if an FIA ran series, something's got to give there. That's my two cents on Tudor not doing it maybe the way that it needs to be done and WEC doing it right.
Speaking of doing it right, shifting over to NASCAR, somebody did it right and earned himself a chase berth after a, once again, rain-delayed, long-delayed finish in NASCAR. Kurt Busch owned everybody at Richmond. Joey, what did you think of the race?
You know, personally for me, I thought finally, I don't want to word this right because this is the way this is going to get interesting reactions probably. You know, this is, depending on how you feel about the off-the-track issues, this was either A, very popular win, or B, it was very disgraceful. Looking back at California, he should have won that race, and there was a very controversial caution/caution and more cautions until ultimately things ended up being in Brad Keselowski's favor at the end. And, you know, this was 291 laps led by this guy in pure dominating fashion with his teammate finishing second. Once again, Harvick grabbing another runner-up finish this year, finishing in the top two for like the umpteenth time in just as many starts, it seems. But, you know, good for him, in my opinion. You know, given everything that he's been through, you know, off the track, it's a disaster. On the track, it's gold. And I think as long as you can keep that man on the track and around the track, you'll be relatively safe if he doesn't, in my opinion, find a girl that he doesn't mix well with, I guess the best way to put that nicely. You know, not a stage five, so to speak. But I was really impressed, actually, looking at the rundown here. Jamie McMurray had a really good shot running in the top three there towards the end. Him and Matt McCall continue to just make gain after gain after gain. Brand new crew chief this year. McCall has really hit on it with McMurray, and I honestly think that they could win multiple races this year. And, you know, Jimmy Johnson sneaking in there and grabbing a third, started at the back of the pack. It's Jimmy Johnson. I don't really expect anything new. I was actually more surprised that Casey Kane, his teammate who started at the back, ended up finishing sixth because he ended up 40th after qualifying. And Kane isn't really notorious for being that kind of guy that ratchets on a car, and works his way to the front and is very methodical, but that's exactly what he was on Sunday. And then last but not least, Clint Bowyer getting the top 10, Martin Truex Jr. continuing to pile on the top 10s, good for him. You know, makes me look good on the pound-for-pound ranking list for having him in there because he continues to do his thing. Very big attaboy for Chase Elliott. Started 16th, finished 16th. I believe it was his third career start. I know he started at Martinsville, and I don't think he started at Bristol for the life of me. I don't remember, but I think this was his third start. And, you know, just some solid days, some big news that's transpired outside of Tony Stewart wrecking. Him and Dale Jr. got together, wrecked. Tony Stewart threw a tantrum, threw his helmet, etc. So his season continues to spiral out of control. The big news this week, and actually within the last few days, it looks like the future of Eric Jones and that 18 car is going to be happening, with Kyle Busch being out still with injuries to his lower body. It looks like they're going to be putting that young hot shoe in that 18, at least until he's better. Kyle Busch is better. But that means that David Ragan might go back to front row, you figure. But that's not the case. He's going actually to the 55. They're taking Brett Moffitt, their developmental driver at MWR, out, who some say subbed superbly. His feedback was there. I'm really harsh on the kid, as some will say, but I just don't want to see a guy develop too quickly because I believe he could be underdeveloped and not ready. They're putting David Ragan in that car for the rest of the year. They don't know how long Brian Vickers is going to be out. So good move on them. Great for David. Puts him in at least a competitive ride that could maybe win a race or two and get in a chase. It gives them the option. And then the big news today that broke just quite a few hours ago, about middle of the day actually, is GoDaddy is not going to be returning to Danica Patrick's team and NASCAR next season. So this is the last year that she's going to actually be running GoDaddy as her primary sponsor. So that is the rundown, the long, not-so-abbreviated rundown, long-winded, and I pass the floor over to you, Frank.
Well, you know what? You say it's an unpopular win by Kurt. I would disagree with that. That's a pretty popular win by Kurt. He's been through a tough time with some, you know, just nonsense, off-the-track nonsense. But we know this guy can drive. So, you know, give him a big, big pat on the back for the win and the whole Danica thing. When I look at the whole thing in perspective, GoDaddy is they're revamping their marketing strategies. They're not choosing to put the $10 or $15 million out front to keep their name on the car. At the same time, they want to keep her as a spokesperson. Danica is still, you know, despite her lack of results on a track, still a very marketable commodity. She'll have a sponsor for that car. She is in a contract year with Stuart Haas, but for all intents and purposes, you know,
Tony Stewart really likes working with her, and I think she'll attract a sponsor. You know, maybe it'll be Aspen Dental. You know, maybe it'll be Tax Act. She's had a couple of other sponsors here through there. So, I you know, while everybody wants to write her off and says she's done, I think Danica's far from done in this sport. And she's literally having her best season ever this year. You know, she had a top five on a short track, I believe it was in Martinsville. So I would not write her off because of sponsor woes. Because if anybody can get a sponsor, Danica can. So there you go.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, currently she holds the most top tens by a female. She broke that record at Bristol, and I mean, she looks like she's finally getting a hold of this car. I know things were a little rough at Richmond, but she made a save at Richmond that was just, I mean, you couldn't ask any driver to make a save better than what she did. So I think she'll find sponsorship, and I think things will kind of come to fruition. If GoDaddy wants, it can take that $10 million over to IndyCar. Just saying.
They already took their money away from IndyCar. Remember that?
God, yeah.
That's why Hinchcliffe drives that plain black car with Arrow on it. So,
but, you know, ultimately, you know, they're heading to Talladega this week. It's a crapshoot. Michael Waltrip's in the 55. This is, I believe, David Reagan's last run in the 18 before they head to Kansas, and he'll be in the 55 after that. So you could throw a blanket under a slew of them and see who wins. But, I mean, at the same time, there are some guys that are just absolutely stellar to play track. This is a good opportunity for Tony Stewart to turn his season around. He's always been pretty solid at plate tracks. He knows the draft really well. He knows the line movement. It would be a great opportunity to see Tony turn his season around to the same effect. This is one final push maybe for David Reagan to get that win, because he's solid at plate tracks too, and he has a knack for it. And, I mean, maybe get one right before he goes over to 55. Those are the two things I'm looking for.
Yeah, it could be. I've watched Tony Stewart over the last year and a half. Seen him struggle through this whole tough time he's had with the short track incident up in New York. And I wonder if it's just time for Tony to step away from the cockpit and just take the owner role on full time.
My best.
That's just for what it's worth. I'm just wondering if Tony needs to step away.
Yeah, they said the same thing about Earnhardt some years ago after his accident, and I'm not ready to write him off yet. I'd probably say if he runs like this the entire season and then the first part of next year, maybe I'll start talking. But him being a champion in the sport, to me, he's earned the right to give him a little bit of time, and hell, he owns the team. So we'll see what happens. Those are my final thoughts as far as it relates to anything racing, is Tony Stewart and him doing his thing.
Yeah, I think Tony's time, as Frank was saying, it might be time to hang it up. But as you were saying, Joey, could this be a last kind of stand? I don't think his head's been right ever since the incident, which, you know, you can hardly blame Tony for. But he's still done an admirable job running the team. He's done an admirable job trying in the cockpit there of the car. So it'll be curious. I do think it's so weird that GoDaddy, after all these years and all the success with Danica, is abandoning her essentially, but still wanting her to be a spokesman. If I were her, I would give them a little salute there and say thanks, but no thanks. But yeah, if anyone can get a sponsor, Danica can get a sponsor. Danica could go racing, short track racing, or, you know, swamp buggy racing and still get a sponsor. So I'm not really concerned about her, but kind of want to move on to final thoughts now for everything. Frank, what are your final thoughts of last weekend and heading into this weekend, all full spectrum of racing?
Well, my final thought is I am dying to see the first oval test of the IndyCar aero kits for ovals. And that's going to be this coming weekend in Indianapolis. and that's going to be as a precursor to the Andretti Grand Prix of Indianapolis. But I'm dying to see the oval racing aero kits, and Honda has said from day one that they designed their aero kit to be strong in Indianapolis, and they did their road course thing as an afterthought. So I just really wonder if the Honda teams are going to just jump up be really strong in Indianapolis and keep the Penske and Ganassi at bay. I just really want to see what's going to happen. So for me, yeah, that's my final thought. Yeah, I cannot wait till you've got all this other stuff going on, Kentucky Derby, all this other nonsense. But let me see this aero kit test.
Josh?
Yep, I'm back on. I mean, my final thought. We got lots of racing this weekend. We got NASCAR from Talladega. I think that's going to be plenty wide open. And then we've got two sports car races from iconic tracks. I think Frank knocked it out of the park. I think we're really excited to see this IndyCar aero kit. I said it all along that there hasn't been enough window for teams to test the aero kit unless you're named Penske or Andretti. So I'm hoping teams get enough time to test the thing and get all the bugs tweaked out, and so IndyCar can make the necessary adjustments heading into the 500.
Joey?
Yeah, I mean, everybody else is looking forward to the unveiling and the testing, and I'm equally looking forward to that because of the intrigue and the hopefulness that something will prevail to make things a little bit more equal, to make it a really fun 500. Surprisingly, at the end of the day, I'm actually kind of intrigued by what this weekend brings with the Grand Prix of Indy, and I never thought I would say that because personally I hate the Grand Prix of Indy. And I'm wondering if we finally get a chance to see somebody take that leap forward. Juan Pablo Montoya is leading the points by, I think, 3 points. And, Penske is still running around the top of the points, even though the results have been mixed, but, this is IndyCar. One weekend you're in first, the next weekend you're in 20th. Will Power's full evidence of that. Everything is very flip-flopped, very competitive. There's everything combined into one, and I'm really interested to see if A. Simon Pagenaud, who won this event last year, finally takes that leap forward as a Penske driver. I seriously doubt it. And I want to see if Joseph Newgarden can run. He doesn't even have to back up what he did at Barber with a win to me. He just has to run strong and maybe get a top four, top five, in my opinion. As long as he hangs around the top four, top five, I want to see that team more solidified. Because last year, he would have hot runs, and he did at Mid-Ohio, and then one race he's running 12th. So I'd like to see that more established. But, at the other end, Andretti Autosport needs to get their shit together and actually do something to consistently finish on the podium. We've had possibility of 12 different guys on the podium out of 23 drivers. Has any of them been Andretti Autosport? Besides Simona at NOLA. But that's the only one I can think of.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And she doesn't run the season full time, and she's just now got passed by Ryan Hunter Ray in the points, and she's a temporary driver. So, yeah.
Oof.
Someone's got to give.
Yeah, for a team that's supposed to be one of the big three, that's bad. But really, it's what Andretti's done. They clawed back a lot of ground on Ganassi and on Penske, and when Hunter Ray won his championship with the DW12, ever since then, they've really been in the mix. And I don't know if it's the Honda issue or it's an Andretti-specific issue. I do think having James Hinchcliffe leave that team hurts them. I think he was a great gel that held the team together, upbeat, lively personality that kind of facilitated it. I still think they have good chemistry within the team. They've got good drivers. They've got a solid leader in Hunter Ray. They've got good leadership from Michael Andretti. So I think they'll be okay. But, you know, as Frank was saying, the thing he's most looking forward to, what, Joey? I know you have a rebuttal.
No, go ahead, finish.
Okay. No, I was just saying. But, you know, Honda may turn it all around with their aero kits more developed for Indianapolis, like Frank was saying. When they first launched it in the road course street circuit short oval configuration, if you look at the video, you could see a couple clips. You had to pause it or slow it down to see the oval configuration. But it's very interesting looking treatment they did with the rear wing. I'm hoping that's the kind of thing we're about to see. The supports are much more like you'd see on a prototype or a sports car. So I'm curious if they have any aerodynamic gains from that. And this is the thing I'm most looking forward to. But as a whole, you know, my final thought is racing season has started. It's well in full swing now. But for me, it doesn't get serious until the month of May in Indianapolis and until Formula One goes back to Europe. And both of those are about to happen within the coming weeks. That's when the real rubber meets the road. That's when development really kicks in. That's when seasons start to have a pattern. You start to see who's really hot and who's really not. And I say, bring it on. It's been a good ride so far, a bumpy ride, very literally for IndyCar. So I'm hoping the upward trajectory from Newgarden's win carries them through May, and we have a really, really great, weird to say, GP of Indy, and also a really great Indianapolis 500.
Only thing I'm going to say that I've been waiting to say is I don't disavow the notion of Hinch leaving Andretti, kind of hurting Andretti, because anytime you have a good driver leaving the team, it always hurts the team. But I think even more so, having Rob Edwards come over from Schmidt-Peterson to Andretti is a huge, huge plus. And in some ways, I kind of like the idea that the Danica distraction isn't around, and in a way, the jokester of Hinch isn't around. As much as I love Hinch, and he's one of my favorite guys, I like the fact that maybe there's an added element of seriousness, like, you know, get your rear end in gear and actually go get it. And it really has now fallen on. Carlos Munoz is there, but for some reason, because he's so new, I don't put this necessarily on him. This squarely falls on Ryan Hunter Ray and Marco Andretti. This is their team to carry, and it is only their team to carry. There is no more Tony Kanaan. There is no more Dario Franchitti. There is no Dan Weldon, unfortunately, over there. You know, at the end of the day, you know, and no Hinch, this falls on them to right the ship and nobody else. And that's what they need. I mean, Marco needs to grow up and really come into his own, and I think he will. I've said it all along for a long time. I think that the mental block is the Indy 500, and if he ever is privileged enough to win that race, if that race finally picks him, I think he's going to just knock off a slew of races because of the potential that we've seen. He has the potential to be in the mix for a podium at every single track and a win at every single track. And maybe that's the gate. Maybe that's the key that unlocks the gate to everything that we saw at Marco when he first came into the sport. But, you know, this process, the engineer being taken from SPM, I think that hurts SPM more than it hurts Andretti to lose Hinch. So that's my final thought to rebuttal your final thought.
All right. I don't know if it's so much of a rebuttal, but I do see what you're saying there about Marco. So for all of us here tonight, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to In the Gravel Trap. This is our 25th episode. Thank you for being with us so far on this journey. I'm Adam Tate of Tribute Racing. On behalf of Joey Barnes, Frank Santoroski, Josh Farmer, and Christopher DeHarney, tune in next week and have a wonderful evening. Good night, everybody.